All right, so this is the second of two webinars introducing the new Fulbright Scholar Alumni Ambassadors. And again, I am Michelle Bellorci. I am an outreach and recruitment specialist with the Fulbright Scholar Program based at the Institute of International Education, IIE. So I hope at this point you can hear and see the slides. Please let us know if the sound is, well, you wouldn't be able to know if the sound is an issue. Let me go to the next slide. We should have our slide check, sound check. But if you can hear the sound, please raise your hand with the hand icon or chat in the question box, the chat box. We have now begun this portion of the webinar. So to give you a little background about the program, for those of you that are new to the program, the Fulbright program is celebrating 75 years next year, and we have partnered with 160 countries worldwide to offer opportunities for passionate faculty, administrators, professionals, and students to study, teach, and research around the world. And the mission of the Fulbright program is to foster mutual understanding and between people of the U.S. and people around the world, and also to advance knowledge through communities. Ultimately, the goal is to improve lives around the world. The program, as I mentioned, is gearing up to celebrate 75 years. It was established by Congress in 1946, and it is the U.S. government's flagship international education and cultural exchange program. It is sponsored by the U.S. Department of State with generous funding, I would have to say, from several of our partner countries around the world, and it is administered by IIE, and we have several offices across the United States administering the program. Diversity and inclusion is a key component to the outreach strategy of the Fulbright Scholar Outreach Team. This statement comes directly from the U.S. Department of State, and their mission and goal is to create a very diverse, robust group of Fulbright scholars that reflect the diversity of the United States. And so opportunities are open for everyone who is eligible to apply, regardless of their race, their color, their background, their religious beliefs, etc. And so this is something that we consider when we develop our outreach strategy, reaching to as many audiences as possible. Now, today's session is unlike other sessions we have. We are here to introduce you to our esteemed and distinguished alumni who have recently completed the program. So this was a competitive process to become an alumni ambassador, and we selected 13 alumni to serve as official representatives of the program and also as a resource for all of you who are considering applying to the program. Think of them as your colleagues or peers to reach out to. Our Fulbright alumni ambassadors represent all world regions where we have programs, as well as all disciplines. They come from a variety of institutions, whether it's community colleges, minority-serving institutions, HBCUs, and Research One institutions. So there's a whole range of representation in terms of that, as well as U.S. geographic location. So we hope that over the next couple of years, you get to have a chance to actually meet our ambassadors, whether they're on the road or on a Zoom presentation, and get to learn more about their experience. So today we have 6 of the 13, and last week we introduced 7 of them, so you can find that webinar archived on our website where you found the link for this one. The reason why we have the Alumni Ambassador Program is actually to augment the outreach approach and to show the impact that a grantee can have as a Fulbrighter. Again, they are a resource not only to you as an applicant, but they're a resource to us as well. We consider them kind of a brain trust, and senior leadership looks to find out the latest kind of information that we need to have about institutions and trends and policies going on in higher education in the country. And so our ambassadors serve as resources of knowledge and advice for us as well. This program is funded actually by the Institute of International Education's Board of Trustees, and it's through a legacy fund. So we are excited today to introduce half of them to you, and without further ado, I would like to pass it over to Professor Greg Alexander.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Give me a second to get unmuted here. So I'm Greg Alexander. I'm a professor of nursing at Columbia University, and I did my Fulbright in 2016-2017. I had applied for a Fulbright scholarship in 2015-2016, but did not receive the award after making it through two rounds. So I was very close, but didn't make it the first time. So I talked to somebody from Fulbright about how to improve my award and received some good information. And what I was told was I needed to strengthen how I would become an ambassador. And so I strengthened that in my application, and apparently I did a fairly good job, and because now I really am a Fulbright alumni ambassador and happy to be representing the Fulbright in this way. So I made those revisions and received the award the second time around. And I had a research Fulbright, which focused on health systems for the aged and technology and quality. And during that time, I traveled to Sydney, Australia, and completed my Fulbright at Macquarie University. I'd been to Australia in 2007, 10 years earlier, before completing my Fulbright, and I was supported by a travel grant from an internal donor at the University of Missouri, where I was at the time. And during that trip, I was exposed to a lot of work going on in Australia that related to my research, so I carried that experience with me through my Fulbright. And the same donor, actually, at the University of Missouri, who supported my travel in 2007, also supported my travel of the Fulbright in 2017. That continued growth in my research over 10 years in the same country was exactly what that person was expecting, and it was a positive outcome for her family. So she felt good about helping support me to do a Fulbright, and that was part of my funding that I used when I was over there. During my Fulbright in Australia, I traveled over 45 residential aged care facilities in 4 out of the 6 Australian states, and I learned about how older people are cared for in that country. And I was also selected to receive a regional travel grant to another country in Australasia, and I selected to go to New Zealand, and I spent 2 weeks traveling and presenting during an aged care lecture series at 3 different universities in New Zealand during that time. So my whole Fulbright was about 5 months long. I continued to have strong collaborations with colleagues from Australia and New Zealand, and as a result of my Fulbright award, and you can read more about my Fulbright. I published an editorial in the Western Journal of Nursing Research in 2018 that outlines a lot of details about my Fulbright, and that could be useful for you if you're interested in applying. And I thank you for your time and for listening to me.
Wonderful. Thank you, Greg. And again, Greg will be doing a Q&A for the second half, so you can ask any questions in the chat if you have specific questions about Australia or if you are in nursing. So please do type those questions in. All right, moving along, we have Brian. Brian, are you on the call?
I am on the call. I'm sorry, people, my video is not cooperating with me today, but hopefully I can talk with you a little bit about my experiences and why I chose the particular program I did. So as you can see all my details there, I'm a professor at University of Oregon of Indigenous Race and Ethnic Studies. And the reason I applied for a Fulbright is that I was doing a project with the Choctaw Apache tribe in western Louisiana on federal acknowledgement as an Indian tribe. And one of the things I kept coming up against was, you know, there's different ways of thinking about what it means to be indigenous in the U.S. versus Mexico. And as a tribe with ancestry from both sides of the U.S.-Mexico border, I had to kind of get better information about what it means to say someone is Indian in Mexico versus in the U.S. So I applied for a Fulbright then just to gain competence and familiarity with those constructions of indigeneity and Mexican racial thinking so that I could help support the Choctaw Apache tribe and do my own work. So I chose a teaching grant, which is different than a research grant, but still has a research component. So I was a U.S. studies chair, which meant that I went for, I taught at a place called UDLA, the Universidad de las Americas in Puebla. And I taught there for one semester and then taught for another month after that in a program that was in part sponsored by the university and their donors and in part sponsored by the U.S. Embassy in Mexico. And it's called the Programa de Liderazgo para Jóvenes Indígenas, the Indigenous Youth Leadership Program. And that was all Indigenous college students from Mexico and Guatemala, and they're open to Native students from the U.S. and Canada as well. But that was one of the great experiences there after the initial moment or the initial assignment of teaching. So I chose that teaching one because it didn't require a letter from a host institution. So if you've started looking to get a letter from a host, you might know that that can be challenging. In particular, there are different kind of customs around formal letters in different countries too. And you might even think about your own institution, how challenging it might be, like you have to go up the tree to your dean and to your president and to whoever it is, or your provost, I don't know. So I also wanted to teach U.S. Indigenous Studies in Mexico as a kind of a diplomatic mission from Native people of the U.S. So I'm a Choctaw from my family's from Western Louisiana, and I wanted to go and do that kind of diplomatic work in that sense. So not going to represent Donald Trump, but going to going to represent Native peoples of the U.S. or to kind of do that work. I liked it too because it was easier to get a semester of leave for my home institution than to get a full year of leave, and it provided this constant structured contact with students. So I think the process then, you know, there were four institutions that I could have matched with in Mexico. Actually three. They came up with a new one because they wanted to send me to this other one further south in Mexico. It worked out very well for me. It worked out well for my academic career. I've been doing publishing or working on publishing articles with colleagues from Puebla, and I keep going back. I just went back in February right before the travel bans went into place. I continue to collaborate with those partners there, and I continue to develop Indigenous Studies exchange programs. We have one at the University of Oregon that we recently developed with the University of Otago. We're working on one with UDLAP in Puebla, and we'll continue to develop those programs as well that are specifically focused on Indigenous Studies in each place. So that's one of the things that I think is important, that we're not just talking about, you know, one generic U.S. culture that is not specific to a place or a people, but rather when we're talking about U.S. studies or talking about Fulbright and the kinds of things that we bring, that it's, you know, specific people and peoples and different kinds of connections that we can build among people.
Great. Thank you, Brian. Excellent. And again, if you have any questions about the award to Mexico that Brian did, or if you are in Indigenous Studies or in American Studies, you can direct your questions to Brian. Next up we have is Carlita Page Anderson. Carlita?
Hello, everyone, and thank you, Michelle. I'm Carlita Page Anderson. Currently I serve as the Vice President of Student Development and Success at Virginia Union University. And certainly before I served in this capacity, I came through the faculty ranks, having been an infectious disease biochemist. So I was in our Department of Natural Sciences during the 2013-2014 year in which I served as a U.S. Fulbright Scholar. In doing so, it was very important to me at the time to identify ways to broaden the extent to which we could engage students to address infectious disease. And as a postdoctoral fellow at Johns Hopkins University, I studied the bacterium that causes tuberculosis. And so it happens that tuberculosis is of high prevalence in Indonesia. And so that's how I identified that country, because I wanted to, you know, go someplace and foster both teaching strategies, but also engage in research to further our knowledge in the mechanisms that contribute to disease for that particular bacterium, but also identify teaching strategies to increase student engagement, to undergird their understanding of basic science concepts, principles, and theories. And so that's exactly what I proposed in my application. I first, again, identified an issue that was of high prevalence in the country I chose to visit, but then also identified an institution that mirrored the same types of values and principles as the institution where that I was representing. And so at Virginia Union University, we are a liberal arts university, and certainly at Erlangga University, or Universitas Erlangga in Surabaya, Indonesia, it is much larger than Virginia Union, but certainly they emphasize basic science research and also teaching pedagogies that increase student participation and activity. And so it was a great match for me. Since returning, I've been able to grow professionally. One of the major outcomes of this appointment was really building out the Center for Undergraduate Research and building faculty research capacity at our own institution, where we are looking to grow our research infrastructure to have more faculty grow their scholarship beyond the classroom. And so we were able to identify the classroom as a way to incubate, if you will, research and engage students in that process, but also lead faculty into growing their various research paradigms based on their specific research niche. So it was an amazing time in Indonesia. I traveled with my family. And so if there's anyone that's interested in how do you travel with a two-year-old and a husband and across the world, I am open to engaging in that regard. But also more specifically, Virginia Union is also an historically black college and university. And so I think there's something to emphasize there in terms of having the institution aware of how this program can certainly add value to it, have the institutional support for faculty to really grow and pursue endeavors in this way. And so I'm really excited to be here. I'm really excited to serve as an ambassador, and I look forward to availing myself to helping anyone in that process.
Excellent. Thank you, Carlita.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And again, feel free to chat in your questions for Carlita. We're getting some good questions coming in. Next we have is Jeff.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Jeff Withy. I'm a professor of biochemistry, microbiology, and immunology at Wayne State University School of Medicine. So I'm a microbiologist. My research area is in cholera primarily, and I study bacterial pathogenesis. So what led up to me applying for the Fulbright was we had a small project that I had done a collaboration with a lab in Kolkata, India, also known as Calcutta. So I had gone over there a couple of times for very short trips. And on the second trip, the guy I was working with, Dr. Hemanta Kole, said, well, you should apply for a Fulbright. You can come over here and we can do some longer-term projects, because we were doing these very short-term things. And I was thinking, well, Jay, I never thought of applying for a Fulbright. That's kind of an interesting idea. So I did a little bit of research and found there was the Fulbright Nehru Senior Scholar Program. So I applied for that, and we had a really good idea for a project because my lab had developed a new model for cholera in zebrafish, which are these little fish about 2 inches long that are actually native to India, and their cholera, the bacteria that cause cholera, naturally live in fish. So we can kind of recapitulate the infectious cycle in these little fish, and because my lab had developed this model, nobody else in the world was doing it. So I was able to take that to India, and I was able to learn a lot from them because they're experts in animal models for all kinds of bacterial infectious diseases. So we had a really strong proposal, I think, that we put together for this, which is important when you apply. You want to have a very strong idea of what you want to do specifically and how it's going to benefit both you and the place that you're going, so the lab, the country, et cetera. So while I was there, I showed them how to do this model with cholera, And we also worked on a couple of other bacterial pathogens, Salmonella and Shigella, which are problems in India, and developed new models in the fish for them while we were there. So I had a really spectacular time. I do remember after I learned I was getting the Fulbright, I was kind of like, holy crap, I'm going to go live in India for 5 months. Am I crazy? But, you know, honestly, since coming back, I've gone back almost every year. I still have strong collaborations there. I developed a huge network with Indian scientists, and I have multiple collaborations with other labs there now. And I miss every day I'm not there. It's such a stimulating environment. I was also able to bring my wife had been there before. My son, who was 14 at the time, had never been there before. They didn't stay with me, but they came and visited. And I have a very strong memory of meeting them in Delhi. My son had never been out of the U.S. And on the first day, he's riding in the back of a cycle rickshaw in the middle of old Delhi traffic. And if you've ever even seen Indian traffic, it's chaotic is a polite way to describe it. So he might have been a little bit terrified, but it was kind of a trial by fire. But it was a great experience culturally, scientifically, personally, life-changing, really. So, yeah, I was there in 2014, 2015. I've gone back, I think, 6 times to India, and I will continue to try to go back every year, and it's been a real positive. And another thing that came out of that, actually, is if you look at that lower photo here, the guy standing to my left now works in my lab. So he was a graduate student in the lab I worked in there, great guy. When he graduated, I said, come do a postdoc with me. You're fantastic. And he's been with me for almost 3 years now and just a really smart guy and has done brilliant work. So I've benefited in basically every way I can imagine from my Fulbright and strongly encourage you to apply. It's actually, as a scientist, you know, one of the challenges was I still had a lab in the U.S. I had to run while I was in India. And it's difficult to have meetings with the weird time change. And at that time, we weren't used to this sort of thing, right? So there was Skype, but we didn't have Zoom or some of these other mechanisms for doing meetings. Now we're all used to this, so it would actually be much easier to run the lab from a distance. So don't let that deter you from doing it. And I think with that, I'll conclude.
Great. No, thanks, Jeff. You bring up a couple very good points. One about kind of the multiplier effect that we hope Fulbright, that all Fulbrighters have, really, in, you know, bringing your one of your students from India as a postdoc to the U.S. You know, the Fulbright connections keep growing. And then also the fact that now that we are in this kind of Zoom and webinar world, it is easier to connect to colleagues back home, and if we need to maintain things or check in, not just with colleagues, but with family as well. So, absolutely. So let's move on. We've got Kimberly Williams next, and she was a grantee to Oman.
Hi, everybody. Good afternoon. So I was a Fulbright scholar in Oman at Sultan Qaboos University in Muscat in 2015-2016. At Temple University in Philadelphia, I'm an associate professor of anthropology, and my research has been in the mortuary rituals of the prehistoric Arabian Peninsula. So I had had a lot of experience working in Oman, and I applied because I wanted to explore a different part of my work. So as an archaeologist, my work rests between the social sciences and the humanities. And much of my work had fallen in the social science side. I wanted an opportunity to spend more time in Oman, to have time to explore the landscape and think about sacred spaces and think about prehistoric mortuary rituals. So I needed more time to be there. Because of the climate in Oman, a normal field season runs, say, November to maybe March or April. But in a typical academic year, I only ever had from the last day of classes or exams in the fall till mid-December until the first day of classes in the spring, which is mid-January, so 4 weeks. So I had to do a whole lot in that time with a big team, and I didn't have a lot of time to explore, and I just didn't have a lot of time. So I applied for a Fulbright Award to spend 10 months in Oman. I applied to work at Sultan Qaboos University, also so I could foster collegial relationships with the scholars there, who I hadn't known very well or at all in most cases. So I had a teaching and research fellowship, and I taught a few graduate classes in their new MA program. But the most important thing that happened was I was able to bring Temple University students to Oman and STU students who were in Oman into my field project. And I was able to join a new field project with my STU colleagues. So that work has continued since then, 2015 until right now. I would be there right now if it weren't for COVID. I typically go back now every winter like I always did, but also every summer. Also because I developed a lot of friendships there, so I have a large network of people to stay with and to visit while I'm there. And I still use the facilities at Sultan Qaboos University to store my equipment and materials and to do my research while I'm there. We developed an MOU between our two universities during my time there. This will help STU students come to the U.S., Temple University, and for scholars and students from Temple to go to STU. We've already had one faculty member from the Department of Archaeology at STU visit Temple University, and I'm hoping that will continue in the future. This continued research, I should have mentioned this earlier, I originally had a 10-month Fulbright Award, and I loved it so much there at STU and with my new colleagues, and I was finding my place in that program so rewarding that I applied for an extension of my Fulbright. So I received a 4-month extension, bringing me to 14 months in Oman on a Fulbright. And then I took a leave of absence for the rest of the academic year, so I stayed for 2 full years. So I'm happy to talk to anyone about what it's like to leave your own culture, your department, your colleagues, your research for that long. I didn't bring family, but I did bring a dog and 2 cats. So I'm also happy to tell you about that. Thank you.
Thanks, Kimberly. You certainly had an unusual experience, I think, a very long Fulbright, which is not typical, but it does bring up the point that extensions are possible. I would reach out, you know, once you're in that situation, you would need to negotiate with the host about funding, but sometimes funding can be extended or at least partially extended, and then of course you would need to negotiate with your home institution, but again, Fulbright can be flexible to a degree. So let us move on, and we have our last ambassador, last but not least, Melissa Kenman-Taylor. So Melissa, are you on the line?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, excellent.
Oh, terrific. Well, at least you can see these pictures from various sites, both in Oaxaca, Mexico, and in the United States. So my name is Melissa Kahneman-Taylor. Most people know me as Misha, and I'm a professor of education, and more precisely of TESOL and World Language Education at the University of Georgia. The project I did in 2013-2014 was a 9-month project, and it was titled Spanish for Non-Spanish Speakers, Cultivating Critically and Creatively Engaged Second Language Learners Across U.S.-Mexico Borders. For many years, from my work as a teacher, as a bilingual teacher in Los Angeles, and through my dissertation work on bilingual education in Philadelphia, my focus was largely on immigrant English language learning communities in the United States. But I started to realize that we really needed to attend to also to U.S. Americans and the cultivated monolingualism that we tend to have in the United States, and to try to understand how and when this was disrupted. So my proposal was twofold. It was both a TEFL scholarship that allowed me to teach English at Huaco, which is the Benito Juarez Autonomous University of Oaxaca, and it also allowed me to conduct interviews with American, U.S. American adults who were pursuing Spanish through long or short-term foreign language classes they were taking in Mexico. So Oaxaca is a very popular destination for language tourism and language days, and so I went to many, many schools and did observations of the ways in which Spanish was instructed and American adults' motivations for studying language and their strategies for acquiring Spanish as adult learners and or adults with family. The picture in the top right corner you can see is me at my children's school. My kids are not in the picture, but those were their classmates, and it was a lot of fun and very difficult to enroll my children in public school in Oaxaca. I had to learn a lot of things about how to be an immigrant parent abroad and learned such new appreciation for what immigrant parents in the United States experience when entering totally new schooling systems, in addition to languages and cultural systems and politeness conventions and the whole nine yards. Down below that picture, you'll see Mario Lopez, who was my host from the University of Oaxaca from the English language program there, and one of our students, Kiara, who is a Zapotec English Spanish trilingual. And I was fortunate to find a place that really nourished my identity as an arts-based researcher and an arts-based pedagogue. So I have both a PhD in educational linguistics as well as an MFA in poetry, and I've done a lot of work in theater. And Oaxaca was very welcoming of these approaches to English language teaching and learning that were through the arts. So Kiara was one of my poetry students, and it was just a delight to teach English language through arts practices. And I also was able to deliver these kinds of practices with students in the classrooms and also at the normal school, which is that picture with myself and a statue in front of the Guanajuato School for Teachers called the Normal Schools in that city. So it's just been an exchange ever since. I've presented at the American Applied Linguistics Conference in the company of Kiara and Mario, and have been back and forth to various parts of Mexico from Georgia. It's easiest to fly into Yucatan, so some of my colleagues and friends have met me in Mérida to facilitate that travel. And now I've started taking the work to the Middle East, so they've been welcoming at the embassies of Jordan and Israel to learn about these arts-based strategies for teaching English. So I'm happy to talk to anybody about the work in Mexico, about navigating systems where senses of time are really different. I think one of the best pieces of advice someone gave to us when we had our Fulbright initiation meeting in Mexico City was try not to do more than one thing a day, which is really hard as an American to understand that, but I really, by the end of the program, learned how to slow down and be present and be a part of a new cultural system. So thanks for listening.
Great. Thank you, Melissa. All right. So so now you've met all of the alumni ambassadors in this webinar today, and I'd like to open it up to questions. We just wanted to share some more pictures from our ambassadors here, but we do have a whole host of questions. I just put these up just in case we didn't have enough. But the first question we have, Carlita, there's actually a couple for you. How did MNF, the Indonesian Fulbright Association Commission, rather, how did they support you in Indonesia? What role did they play? If you could speak a little bit about that.
Sure, that's a great question. So MNF was the primary agency that welcomed me. So Surabaya is the second largest city in Indonesia, and Jakarta is the capital. And so we first flew in, my family and I, to Jakarta and sat down with the MNF staff. And we really, you know, just talked through logistics of what to expect, the cultural nuance that kind of was present throughout the political landscape. My husband works in politics, and so we were in the middle of the third Democratic elections for that country, so it was very interesting to watch that happen. And so MNF was very instrumental in kind of just acclimating us to the culture, if you will, of Indonesia. And then we of course left and then transitioned to Surabaya. But throughout that time, I remained in contact with the staff in Jakarta. We also met in Bali, where I was able to facilitate some of these sessions with Indonesians who were awarded Fulbrights to come to the U.S. to really then reciprocate that understanding of what they were going to go join and how they may want to govern themselves. Everyone was super interested in snow and what the weather dynamics would look like and just some of those practical components that I don't think we really tend to think of, in the areas of the U.S. where we have these different seasons and things like that. So I was very much engaged and very much pleased with the interaction with Aminef. And I guess I'll say this too as well. They were also very open to feedback. There were some things about our transition to Surabaya, specifically identify living arrangements that weren't always coordinated in the way that we would like. And so my family and I, we decided to stay in a hotel for about 3 weeks in order to kind of really establish ourselves in the city. And I'll say that, you know, Aminef was really, really open to coordinating those efforts and making some changes, if you will, to improve the way in which it received scholars for time periods to come. So it was a pleasure to work with them, and they were certainly open to our experience in our transition.
Great. The next question, I'm going to throw it out to all of you, perhaps not Greg, though. It says, most of you were based in countries that were not English-speaking, and how did you prepare for that? How did you navigate that? So maybe if we could kind of go around the room, so to speak.
I'll start. I've been taking Arabic for a long time, which doesn't necessarily help you speaking in day-to-day with the local version. Sorry for the guest speaker in the background. I'll mute and then I'll come. I might have a minute now. Sorry about that. But I also took an evening class and for a short, maybe 6 weeks. And then I had a tutor that I met with every week.
I'll jump in on that since I saw an opportunity. This is Melissa or Misha Conman-Taylor. I'm in that Guanajuato picture down below. I'll say that I thought I was fluent in Spanish before my Fulbright. I really thought I was fluent, and people told me I was fluent, and I passed tests that said I was fluent. But all of a sudden, I had so many different subsets of words I had to learn when our water went out and our electricity and the language of the public schools that where my kids were going, and comida chatarra. I had to learn junk food, like, you know, different words that I just hadn't been introduced as an academic before. It was hard, and also it was difficult because I was in charge of all, I was the only fluent member of my family, although quickly my kids seemed to outpace me, and they seem to have quickly lost their Spanish since, but I think it's in there, but it's quite overwhelming and rich and wonderful to be pushed into a new language. But one of the criteria for Mexico, I believe, on my Fulbright was one had to have high proficiency. And that was clear in the interview that I had prior to winning the award. And it was really clear why you need it upon, you know, receiving and experiencing the award. So my Spanish language learning is never ending. I'll pass it to someone else.
Okay.
I'm sorry. This is Carlita again. I'll say I did not speak and still do not speak Bahasa, which is the native language of Indonesia at all. This was a huge concern of mine and my family, but we were assured that that was not a requirement, and so we kind of just went along with it. And I will say, Once joining the University of Arlanda community, the students that you see me pictured here at the bottom, their English was amazing. I was assigned a translator throughout the time, so to help pay bills, I had a translator, or I had a driver that would help me and my family and I navigate different spaces to serve as a translator. But I will say that there's a generational shift in Indonesia where the younger population is very much fluent in English, and they were able to engage, and they were very helpful in really approaching some of the senior faculty who were not as strong in their English, but they really helped push those boundaries to really foster communication and dialogue. And certainly by the time, you know, we were leaving, certainly my family and I, we learned some, but that was one of the hurdles that we were concerned about, but it forced us to be really dependent upon other ways of communication that we hadn't done before. And so I really valued how I'm able to really find myself in different environments where, you know, talking isn't the only way that you can engage, and that was something we were able to learn while we were there.
This is Greg. I might take this a little bit from a different angle, so that's me standing in front of the University of Canterbury in Christchurch, New Zealand, during my aged care lecture series. I gave a lecture there. And one of the things, even though I chose to go to a country that was primarily English-speaking, that doesn't mean that everybody speaks the same language that you speak in your country. So in the United States, you know, we have we take very for granted our systems, and if you've always lived in the United States, it's easy to take for granted the systems that we have in place and how we do our business and how we conduct our business and how you communicate during those periods of time. And when I went to Australia and also New Zealand, I found that there were lots of different customs that were very specific to those countries. They were very, very reverent of the people that owned the lands prior to us being there in both countries. And they had Maori and New Zealand are the indigenous people that they respect every time they have a meeting. And I was very cautious about how I communicated during those meetings, because I wasn't part of those customs in my life. You know, we don't in the United States carry on meetings where we thank people that come before you in the land. And it's a very different kind of a custom, but it's a very reverent kind of custom. So it's important to learn from those cues and learn how they do things. But not take them on as if you do know what they are talking about, because I thought I understood exactly what they were talking about in relationship to how they really lift up these people and the owners of the land. And the people that I was close to cautioned me that people from the country really needed to lead those kinds of conversations. And it wasn't really appropriate for me to do that because I wasn't from that country. So I really had to be very cautious about how I spoke. We were also in an election year. That was when President Trump was elected. I went the very month that he was elected. And people in Australia were extremely interested in what was going on with us politically. And I was very cautious about how I approached questions related to that. And so if you want to talk about that kind of thing, I'm certainly happy to talk about that too.
So when I arrived in Calcutta, the native language there is Bangla, and many people also speak Hindi, but English is fairly common there. So, I mean, Calcutta was the capital of British India for 200 years or something. So a lot of the signs there are in both Bangla and English. However, many people there don't speak English, so I didn't really have a lot of problems. One of the things that I would do differently is try to learn more Bangla at the beginning of my trip, I mean, because I did pick some up over time, especially in terms of reading it. So I took the bus from where I lived to where I worked almost every day, sometimes took a taxi. Taxi drivers generally didn't speak English, and the bus sometimes had words in English and sometimes just had words in Bangla, so I'd have to yell my destination to the guy who collects the money, and he would say yes or no, basically, and I'd know whether to get on the bus or not. Eventually, I, with some help from friends learned to read the script, and then it was much easier to get around because then I could just read what was on the bus and where it was going, or an auto rickshaw similarly. But, you know, if you can just pick up a few words, you're in the market, you can point at things and say, I want that, and people figure it out. You can communicate even with no knowledge fairly well, and I really didn't have a lot of issues with language.
When I started in Mexico, my Spanish was very much an intermediate level. I had one semester of Spanish in college, and that was it. But then they wanted me to teach my wife and in-laws are Mexican, so Spanish is very much part of the household. They wanted me to teach at that university where I was. They wanted me to teach in English. That was part of the reason I was brought there, was to teach U.S. studies in English. And it's a bilingual university. And my four sons were 13, 14, 15, and 16, and had varying levels of Spanish proficiency. And they went to a bilingual school as well, rather than just throw them into all Spanish when they don't know it that well, which, you know, would be fine if we were there for longer than a semester, I think. But their frustration was that at their school, no one would speak to them in Spanish because it was so much easier for them to just speak in English. There was that element. But in terms of, I think Misha brought up the issue of domains of language knowledge. And so the worst thing for me was trying to call to get the cable set up at my house. I look at people's body language a lot to understand what it is they're talking about, and that really helps a lot. But when you're on the telephone, man, forget it. It's not only a little bit, the whole phone number system is different, but then it's just very challenging sometimes. But I'll say, for the most part, even with just an intermediate level of Spanish, once you're thrown into it, you learn to swim pretty quickly.
Great. Thank you, Brian. And I know that we've reached the hour, but because we did start a few minutes late, I have a couple of questions that I want to pose to all of you, and then we can wrap up. So if you're able to, we will stay on for a few more minutes. The question that we have is to, and again, this is for all of you, Did you use the Fulbright to try something new and grow, something like a new class, a new syllabus, teaching a new age group instead of undergrad or graduate students, et cetera? Or did you think it was best to continue with what you were doing at your home institution? So whoever would like to take that first.
I'd like to jump in first on that, if that's okay. My PhD is in American Studies, and I'm very much a Native American Studies / Ethnic Studies scholar. And so I was not particularly familiar. I felt like when I started this new project with the Choctaw Apache tribe, I needed to get a new PhD in Latin American Studies to really understand what was happening. And so I thought of this as like a part of that training. It really did help with research, but also with, I've developed classes as a result as well, and it absolutely has changed my competence in a bunch of areas. So, yeah.
This is Greg. I'll answer that question. So in my research, I had developed a survey in the United States about the use of information systems in long-term care nursing homes. And part of my research plan for Australia was to take the survey there and to do a statewide Wales. And when I got there and I started talking to people about the survey, I realized that the language in the survey was very different, even though it was in English. It was very different than the terms they used in their country. So I ended up going around to all these administrators in the 50 nursing homes that I visited and showing them the survey, and they gave me feedback, and I revised the survey, and then I used it as a pilot in the New South Wales research study that I conducted. And what's interesting about that is that just in the last year, I've worked with a panel with the Department of Health in Canberra, which is their capital, like Washington, D.C. is to us. Canberra is Australia's capital. And I worked with the Department of Health, and they used the survey that I revised to do a national study about IT in nursing home and residential care facilities that I had revised. And so that was an unforeseen positive benefit of the work that I did there, and it actually extended into several reports that I've done for the government and with people that are in government there. So I felt like I'm blessed to have a project that really had policy impacts as well, and I had to have the right language in the instrument. It essentially became a new instrument after the Fulbright.
So I can add in now. This is Melissa, who spent her time in Oaxaca, Mexico, and then later Guanajuato. My project, so I have developed a line of considerations of methodology where we often in education turn to the hard sciences to understand trends in teaching and learning. There's also a very strong qualitative research component. And I took that, I guess, a step further as an artist, as a trained poet and theater artist, to try to understand how the arts were also tools for qualitative data collection, data analysis, and representation. So my project was a development on that. It was like trying to figure out how to collect ethnographic data, participant interviews with American Spanish language learners and observations of Spanish classrooms, and then to work with that creatively. And I developed a book of poems called Imperfect Tense and a Play, and performed that play at the Anthropology Conference. Maybe Kimberly caught it. I don't know. No, I'm not sure. Maybe we'll see each other at Anthro. So I am in the Society for Humanistic Anthropology and Anthropology of Education, and trying to figure out, you know, how to use new tools to understand the human condition. And so it was both like an outgrowth of things I'd done before, but also took me in really new directions. Someone else?
Can I add something here? I had mentioned that I was hoping to move my research more towards the humanities away from social sciences, not to abandon it, but to be able to spend more time focusing on it. And I came back from my Fulbright and was then named director of the Center for the Humanities here at Temple. So I've moved in that direction. So it allowed me the time and the space to do that. And I think, frankly, in the race to get tenure, and focusing on getting articles out of the door and not the luxury of being able to think about what we maybe more want to think about sometimes, or write about what we want to write about sometimes, because we're concerned with the tenure timeline. The Fulbright allowed me that space. And I think it's different from other grant opportunities in that it's an individual grant. Of course, you can be the sole principal investigator on an NSF or NIH or NEH, but really good large-scale research requires more than just one person. But a Fulbright award allows you to go and have an experience and conduct individual research. You're, of course, going to be working with local people there and interacting, and it's never just yourself, but you get the luxury of focusing on yourself more than you would with, I think, any other grant opportunity that we commonly see.
I want to say that, when I submitted the award for my research, it was like a year and a half before I actually went. And so by the time that the award came around and I moved to Australia, the plan that I had for that award was still pretty much intact, but I would encourage any of you that do this kind of thing to be flexible in your approach, because when you get to the country that you're going to and you begin to implement what you said you would do, you'll always find there's some, or I think, and at least in my case, you'll always find that you have to be flexible enough to bend with the country that you're in, because it's very different living there once you get there. For example, the 15 administrators, they were not in one small little location. Like I said, they were in 4 or 6 states. And I didn't have a car, and I had my family. So I had to figure out how to get to and from all of these places, trains, planes, boats, ferries, buses. I got to know the Australian transportation system incredibly well, and it's very different than ours. And you know, I didn't plan on that. And so it was something that I had to be very, but I had to do it in order to do the research. And so you need to be flexible. And also work some time into those periods where you're really working hard to have some fun. So every time that I went to one of those residential aged care facilities, I'd spend about 5 hours with the administrator and looking around the facility, and then I would take time to go somewhere really beautiful around that area. And so I kept a journal about all of that stuff. So it's, you know, it's just part of the flexibility of being a Fulbright.
Thanks, Greg. I wanted to jump here and say that for me, it was all about learning something new. So, pursuing that tenure track, as Kimberly said, and really being driven by infectious disease research, you know, when you're looking for funding opportunities, Fulbright is not what you typically think of to further that narrative. But in my institutional context, at being a primarily teaching university, this was an opportunity for me to grow in a way as a professor, but also as a scientist that I really hadn't thought about. And so I really was able to identify new ways of pedagogy, new ways of learning just about how this When we say we're studying infectious disease, you know, we always identify that, you know, we're doing this for the betterment of the world, which is actually true, but it's a very, very different experience to go to a different country where the disease that you're working on highly impacts the persons of that country. It just gives you a completely different context, and I think as a result of living amongst the community, I really was able to think about what I was doing as a scientist to advance knowledge in terms of biochemically, how that really was being able to impact the community. And so it just was a way to become a better scientist, I believe, that was not afforded by other funding mechanisms.
I'll just jump in here and say I already told the group that I was able to work on a couple different bacterial pathogens that I had never worked on before when I was there in India. But I just want to reiterate what Carlita just said, in that when you see diseases on the ground, it's different from working in a lab, and it really changed your perspective. So, you know, I work on cholera. We don't have cholera in the U.S. They have lots of it there. There's lots of shigellosis there. You know, there are lots of infectious diseases there that we don't see here, including a lot of vaccine-preventable ones. And the largest infectious disease hospital in Calcutta was next to where I was working, So, you know, that was full of people with diseases that we don't see here. And you gain not only an appreciation for how serious the problems are, but it changes your ideas about what can I do. So, you know, before that, I'm a basic scientist. I like figuring out how stuff works. And now you start thinking about, well, how can I use that to maybe come up with something that might be therapeutic? And the lab that I was working with does vaccine work, which I'd never worked on vaccines. So I was able to get that perspective as well. So it really did change my way of thinking about science and life generally. The only other thing I wanted to add was I developed a great appreciation for crickets.
Excellent. Thank you, Jeff. All right. So for those of you, I just wanted to follow up with one more question, but for those of you that had specific questions for our ambassadors, I just want to go back to their individual pages. Please note their email addresses at the bottom of their slides. So this is Melissa, who was a grantee to Mexico. Kimberly, if you can just note that or take a picture. We'll also upload this archived webinar next week, so feel free to contact them after that's uploaded, or you can contact me at scholars@iie.org, and we can direct you to them. Here's Jeff's slide. Carlita can be reached here. You can see her email at the bottom there. And Brian, and then Greg. So the last question I have for you, and then I'll let everyone get back to their Thursday afternoon, and this is for everybody. If you could do it all over again, what would you do differently on your Fulbright, whether it's the length of time, you name it?
I'll say I wish I had taken advantage of the opportunities to visit more Fulbright countries in the region. I wasn't able to tear myself away, and I haven't been able to visit all of the Gulf countries, and this would have been a nice way to connect with colleagues there, because when you're approaching colleagues at in a different university, a different country, and you say, I'm a Fulbright scholar, it helps get that meeting for you. And so I wish I had taken advantage of that and visited other countries. So don't get so tunnel vision. So if you love where you are, take a small break and go away for a couple of days to take advantage of being in that part of the world.
This is Greg. I think the only thing that I would do different is I would have done it maybe 10 years earlier, because I've had international relationships with and friends from countries that do similar work to I do, but I just never thought about doing a Fulbright until, you know, it just struck me that this mechanism could really help me solidify a lot of those relationships and build some community internationally. And the benefits that I've received from this would have really helped catapult me earlier in my career, not only with relationships, but just in understanding other people and places. And, you know, I just would have done it earlier.
This is Carlita again. This is an important question and really difficult, but I guess I'll say I probably should have talked about this more when I returned. I'm very introspective person, and so upon my return back to the U.S., I spent time just thinking about how this impacted myself and our families, that I didn't really broadly share it beyond kind of our inner circle. And so I'm excited about being an ambassador to tell that story more, to be a bit more intentional about sharing with others the impact this program had on myself and my family. I think that's the biggest difference, and I'm just excited to be able to do this more formally and impact the lives of others in a different way.
This is Brian, and I think I would have started applying earlier. I do a lot of things by the seat of my pants, I guess, but this one, as I was started looking, the Fulbright deadline used to be a lot earlier, too. So I think the deadline, I mean, maybe someone can correct me, but I think it was like July 15th or August, I don't know. But it was not a traditional kind of, for my field, academic deadline. Where most of our academic deadlines are in the fall. This one, this year's deadline is September 15th. So you guys are actually, that are listening in, are in a good position to get some organizing done for that application deadline. And what I mean by that is if you're thinking about a particular country, talk to the International Affairs Office or International Something Office at your home institution and see what kind of connections they have with different institutions in country. So I found out a little bit later that there are some institutions that my university already has relationships with, and that my colleagues already have relationships with, that might ease that process of trying to get a letter or of deciding where you might go, what institution you might use as your host. So it's to me that's. No, I have. That's the only thing I would do differently. Everything else was perfect. So it's good that you're at least 2 months ahead of time, and if you're on this webinar, then you already were looking a little bit before this too, so you're in good shape.
So I'd say the only thing I would do differently is have stayed longer. So at the time, 5 months seemed really intimidating, and it flew by, and I was really sad when I had to leave because we were doing so much good stuff, and it was such a fantastic experience that I would have done it for 2 semesters instead of 1 if I had the chance. So when you're applying, make sure you consider that, because it does seem, I'm going to be away from home for 4 or 5 months. That seems really long, but it's really not. It'll fly by. And the other thing I already kind of mentioned, but if you're in a place where you don't speak the language, try to learn it as quickly as possible, at least some of it as quickly as possible. There are probably resources there where you can get tutored or take a course. You can do that before you leave in some cases, just so you have a little bit of vocabulary. That'll really help you a lot when you get on the ground.
Excellent. Well, thank you. I think all of you brought up very good points, and I'll share my webcam again as we wrap up. So all of you had different pieces of advice, whether it was staying longer or branching out and meeting more Fulbrighters, starting the application earlier. And also, Carlita, I love your point about talking about it more. So that's exactly what we'd like you to do. So all of you that are on the call, if you eventually do become a Fulbrighter, please do share more about your experience, not only while you're in country and get your name out there as a Fulbrighter, but once you come back to the U.S., let your colleagues know, arrange a talk, invite your colleagues maybe from abroad to be Fulbrighters in the U.S. But again, just to wrap up, for those of you listening in today, the Fulbright Scholar Awards competition is live. We are accepting applications for the 2021-2022 academic year. So the deadline is September 15, so you've got about 5 weeks to work on an application. I think it is plenty of time. And again, please reach out with any questions. I've put on the screen the contact here, scholars@iie.org. Feel free to contact our wonderful alumni. I know there were some questions about bringing pets, bringing family, all that, so please direct them to the appropriate ambassadors, and also some questions for Greg about nursing and what exactly you did, a little more information. We've put in the chat the link to Greg's Fulbright article that he published, so if you'd like to access that, the link is in the chat box. And other than that, I want to thank our panelists for joining us today, and I want to wish all of you all the best on your application, and good luck, and see you next time. Bye-bye.